Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Setlist, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Ticketmaster, Frank Sinatra and Cliff Richard. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're looking back at the last week in the music business, a week when Impala lodged concerns with the European Commission over the seismic, I quote, impact of Sony's EMI deals. And Madonna turned 60 to much fanfare.
A lot of fanfare. A lot of top 60, top 10, top 5 lists related to Madonna's 60th birthday, which you very kindly aggregated for our readers slash listeners into the top 60 list of top 60s. I noticed that one of them, well, first of all, there was an awful lot from The Independent on the list.
The Independent did a lot of lists.
I mean, The Independent isn't a print newspaper anymore, but if it was, I can't help thinking that last Thursday's edition just would have been an entire 60-page special of Madonna lists.
Yep.
But there was one, I think, on a foreign website, which was a top four. Four things to do to celebrate Madonna. You think you could come up with five, wouldn't you? I mean, to just do four seems a little bit lazy.
Coming up with five is the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
So they were being a little bit, well, so it's like Madonna. Madonna is always edgy, going against the norm. You think they were embracing that in their slightly pathetic excuse of a Madonna list. The other thing that happened this week is that Disney responded to that lawsuit we talked about on a previous edition of Setlist that was launched by the Michael Jackson estate. So the Michael Jackson estate sued Disney, specifically Disney's ABC TV division, over a documentary that ABC put out earlier this year, claiming copyright infringement because the documentary featured various songs and videos of Michael Jackson in which the estate has a stake or owns or controls. And they were saying ABC didn't get permission to use any of that content, and that's copyright infringement. And that was the lawsuit. But what was interesting about Disney's response last week is that they basically said everything that we said they would say.
Yeah, well, that's probably because they based their defence on this show.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything that we said would be raised in the defence was there in their submission to court responding. So that means one of two things, or maybe one of three things. It may mean that they listen to Setlist.
I think that's most likely.
I'm assuming
number
that's
one.
The... Number two is I'm such an expert on this that I should probably quit this nonsense and go and set myself up as a media lawyer in California.
I'm sticking with number one.
I think that would probably be a much better gig myself. Or number three, the arguments they are presenting in their defence are so freaking obvious that anybody who knew anything would have come up with the same list that we did.
It's number one for me.
I suspect it might be number three, but even if it is, I think I might still go for number two and relocate myself. So basically, as expected, they said that, okay, yes, ABC had used a whole load of little clips of Michael Jackson songs and videos in their documentary, and they didn't get permission from the Michael Jackson estate or anyone else to use those clips. But hey, First Amendment free speech rights. Hey, fair use under American copyright law. We're allowed to do that. So Disney, you can go away, was basically the gist of their defence. But we knew that because we said that's what was going to happen weeks ago.
Yeah, so if you want to know what happened, go back and listen to that episode of Setlist. But don't go and do that just yet, because those aren't the things we're discussing this week. We've got a whole show ahead of us still that you can listen to before you go and listen to that other one from weeks ago that you've already heard. You don't need to listen to that again. You can. I mean, you probably should listen to every episode of this multiple times. But all I'm saying is we've got things to talk about.
Yeah, and those things have nothing to do with Impala, Madonna or Disney.
Not as far as I know. We are going to discuss Warner Chappell going legal in a dispute over Frank Sinatra songs, and the BBC's decision not to appeal the court ruling over its coverage of a police raid on Cliff Richard's Berkshire home. But first, Ticketmaster UK last week announced that it is shutting down both of its ticket resale sites, Get Me In and Seatwave. The company plans to allow capped price resale within its main website instead, starting later this year, which is a dramatic move that will see the Live Nation ticket company bail on secondary ticketing all across Europe.
Yeah, so that was a very bold announcement from Live Nation last week. And in Europe, at least, because I suppose it is worth stressing that the announcement was just about Europe, and Live Nation has big secondary ticketing operations elsewhere in the world, particularly in the US.
Yeah.
But in Europe, it sort of totally reframes the debate around secondary ticketing and ticket touting. Because as we have discussed at various points on past editions of Setlist, when we've had the whole ticket touting, secondary ticketing debate, it has been interesting in the last few years, as the anti-ticket touting campaign has gained new momentum, that what has happened on a number of occasions, particularly when this whole thing has ended up, say, in Parliament in Westminster, where you have on one side of the room all the people from the music community, artists, managers, agents, promoters, who are saying ticket touting is bad, the second ticketing sites are irresponsible, we need to get these things regulated. And then on the other side of the room, you have the eBays and StubHubs of this world, usually not Viagogo because they don't show up,
no.
but the companies who have a vested interest in ticket touting, and Live Nation, which would usually want to go and sit with the artists and the promoters and the agents on the one side of the room, was sitting next to StubHub and eBay defending secondary ticketing. And so that within Europe will now change. Ticketmaster, Live Nation's ticketing company, ended up in secondary ticketing through a few acquisitions in sort of the late 2000s and the early part of this decade. And I suppose we've talked before about the story of the secondary ticketing debate, the online ticket touting debate, and how when ticket touts started selling tickets on eBay in the early to mid 2000s, and then we started to get the StubHubs of this world appearing, websites that were specifically for reselling tickets. In the mid to late 2000s, there was quite a bit of hoo-ha in the music community about the growth of online ticket touting. Consumer rights organisations like Which were coming out and saying something should be done about this. And quite a few politicians started to say, yeah, this isn't consumer friendly, we need to do something about this. But we then had that whole period where the music community kept saying to the politicians, we want you to do something about this. And then the politicians would say to the music community, no, we think you should do something about this. And the politicians were thinking that the music industry should fix it. The music industries were thinking the politicians should fix it. And so there was a lot of debate for 2-3 years. Nothing happened. And then the whole sort of momentum around the campaign to try and regulate secondary ticketing kind of fizzled out. And there were still occasional moments, stories that would put secondary ticketing back into the news. And there were certain people, I suppose Harvey Goldsmith, who we were talking about on last week's set list, because he'd been speaking about what's happening in Ireland. I mean, he was quite vocal throughout that we should try and regulate secondary ticketing. Sharon Hodgson, Labour MP in Westminster, was pretty adamant throughout that something must be done. But there was that whole period where quite a lot of people in the music industry just reached the point where they said, nothing's going to happen. There's nothing we can do about this. So if you can't beat them, join them. And let's just try and make the best of a bad situation. We can't stop secondary ticketing. We can't regulate online ticket touting. The politicians have been very clear. They're not interested in doing that. So maybe we should try and get involved in this and see if we can make a bit of money as well all the dodgy touts. And so that was when you had that whole period where we know there were promoters and artists and venues and managers and agents who were touting their own tickets, either directly by going on to the resale sites and selling them themselves, or by doing deals with touts or ticket brokers, as they would call themselves, get a load of money up front and allowing those touts, those brokers, to then sell the tickets on a StubHub or a Viagogo or whatever. And it's during this time that Ticketmaster here in the UK and elsewhere in Europe got involved in the secondary ticketing business. And it did that in Europe through two main acquisitions. So first of all, Get Me In here in the UK, which was a secondary ticketing site that became part of Ticketmaster. Then a little bit later, it bought Seatwave, which had operations in various European markets. And then ever since then, Ticketmaster has been a key primary ticketing agent over here, but also operates two of the big secondary ticketing sites in Europe over here. Some argue that that has contributed to consumer confusion about what is a primary ticketing site and what is a secondary ticketing site, because I would say that of all the brands in ticketing, maybe all the brands in live entertainment or even the music industry at large, Ticketmaster has an incredibly high profile. And so what consumers started to do was they would land on sites like Get Me In or Seatwave. They would see a Ticketmaster logo because it would say a Ticketmaster company.
Yeah.
And they would assume, oh, this must be a legit official primary ticket seller, when of course it wasn't. So arguably, Ticketmaster being involved in secondary ticketing was adding to that consumer confusion. And then, as we've just talked about at length here on Setlist, in the last 2 or 3 years, in multiple countries around the world, and particularly here in the UK, the anti-touting movement has gained new momentum. So here, the aforementioned Sharon Hodgson teamed up with a Conservative MP called Mike Weatherly, managed to get a little bit of regulation over secondary ticketing into the Consumer Rights Act in 2015. That then resulted in the government being forced to instigate a review of the entire sector, the Waterston Report. And all of that resulted in the managers, the agents, the artists who had got a bit quiet on all of this, but who were angry about ticket touting throughout, to sort of regroup, and they formed this thing called the Fanfare Campaign, and they got more organised. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a lot more action in this domain. So people in the music industry being much more vocal, artists like Ed Sheeran, but many others too, big name artists, getting much more full on in trying to stop the touting of their tickets and cancelling the touted tickets, and a lot more pushing in Westminster and Whitehall to get more regulation. And this time round, the politicians have been much more receptive to that, yeah, in saying, yes, maybe we should regulate, some light regulation. And all of this has created PR challenges for Live Nation Ticketmaster because, as I say, they've suddenly found themselves on, for them, the wrong side of the table, the wrong side of the room. And so there has been increasing pressure on Live Nation Ticketmaster to do something about it. Although I'm not sure even, I mean, there was rumour that this was coming for a few weeks, but I think 6 months ago, most people on the anti-touting side of the debate would not have predicted that within a year, Live Nation would basically have bailed on secondary ticketing in this form throughout Europe completely.
Yeah, and it's sort of, they didn't make a big, although like everyone reported on this from obviously the music business press like us, but also like the BBC, Guardian, like, you know, kind of, you know, the mainstream media as well. This was a big story, although Ticketmaster actually just put it up as a post on their blog, which normally is just posts promoting things that they've got tickets for. Suddenly this thing saying, oh, we're shutting down a couple of companies came up, which, I mean, I don't know who goes on that blog, but it's probably not what they were expecting. And as you say, it wasn't what anyone was really expecting. But those two sites, Get Me and Seatwave, will shut down in the autumn. They're not taking any more new listings for tickets. Any tickets that are currently listed on there will continue to be so. But once all those tickets are gone, then everything's gone. It all shut down. So Ticketmaster said in this blog post, that's right, we've listened and we hear you. Secondary sites just don't cut it anymore, and you're tired of seeing others snap up tickets just to resell for a profit. All we want is you, the fan, to be able to safely buy tickets to the events you love.
Which, even if they didn't intend it to be read in quite that way. As you say, it's interesting. It's a very chatty, informal announcement on their blog. It's a consumer-facing blog, not an industry-facing blog. As you say, the post underneath it, because I knew the blog post was coming, and so I was refreshing the blog, waiting for it to go live. And the one below it was the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah.
So another thing that's very much on our radar at the moment. But a very chatty, informal blog post sort of subtly posted out there. Although, I mean, they must have realised that as soon as it was live, it was then going to get picked up by a lot of newspapers because there have been so much coverage about secondary ticketing, particularly in the last 12 months. But I suppose in that quite chatty, informal paragraph, that is basically Live Nation completely switching sites and saying, A, here's some functional information. These sites will no longer be taking new listings. We're moving out of this space. But B, it sort of really feels like it is Live Nation in Europe. So that will be interesting because now they've sort of got different policies in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
But in Europe, this is Live Nation seemingly saying, we're now on this side of the room. Whenever secondary ticketing is going to come up, we're going to be on the other side of the room throwing stuff at big bad StubHub and Viagogo on the other side of the room. Not that Viagogo ever show up, but we can have, like, I don't know, some sort of
have a little target.
A toy to represent them. And we're going to join in the campaign that says that ticket touting is bad. Now, the other part of their announcement last week was, as well as shutting Seatwave and Get Me In down, they're going to relaunch the main Ticketmaster site. And I suppose this is where it's important to make a distinction between basic ticket resale, where a fan who can no longer attend a show has the ability to sell that ticket on, versus ticket resale for profit.
Yeah.
And I suppose generally when you talk about ticket touting, you're assuming that the ticket has been marked up. Even though I think most ticket touts would want to point out that half the tickets that they buy, they sell on at a loss, at below face value. But I suppose it is the markups that people are angry about. And so when Ticketmaster relaunched their site, they will allow resale, but it will be capped resale.
Yes, and so this feeds into that kind of fan-friendly attitude that came across in the blog post. Because one of the excuses secondary ticketing sites have always used is that, well, if you buy a ticket from Ticketmaster or wherever, if you can't go to the show, you can't get a refund on that ticket from Ticketmaster or whoever you bought it from. So you're stuck with it. And so the secondary ticketing sites offer a service to those people who want to get rid of the tickets that they've bought but now can't use.
And of course, the StubHubs and Viagogos of this world, and until last week, the Seatwaves and GetMeIns of this world, have always insisted that's our primary business.
Yeah.
The main reason we exist is because people buy tickets to shows, then they can't go. Because the live industry has this no refund policy, not always, but in most cases, that's unfair. And so we exist to help them sell on their tickets. And StubHub in particular always likes, I can't remember the figure, but it was some stupidly high figure, like 90% of the people selling tickets,
I think it was higher than that,
on our platform or people in that situation. And then of course the fanfares of this world would say, well, that might be true, but the 5% who are industrial level touts are probably 98% of the tickets being sold. They may only be 5% of the people selling, but they are the vast majority of the tickets being sold. And really, the StubHubs and Viagogos of this world, okay, they may provide that service and people may be using it for that purpose, but their core business, where they make their money out of their commissions and their fees, are the industrial level touts who are all about hoovering up large quantities of tickets for in-demand shows and then putting a massive markup on them.
But then they say there's a two-level thing. One, not only are they shutting down their own resale sites, they are setting it up now so that people can... You can't get a refund because that policy still exists. But if you buy a ticket from Ticketmaster and then find that you can't go to the show, then you can sell it on to another fan at face value or less. So no selling for profit, just I can't use this ticket, I just want my money back, can't get a refund, but someone else might want it and that'll get me money back and we'll just call it quits.
Now, of course, we should stress, Ticketmaster haven't invented this concept.
No.
This idea of capped face value resale, or what's sometimes called ethical resale.
Just, that's existed for a long time.
And of course, there are websites that were set up specifically to enable that. Twickets is probably the highest profile of those.
Yeah, Scarlet Mist is the really long-standing site that offered that service.
But what Twickets did that was different to some of the earlier sites in that space was it formed official partnerships with artists or venues or festivals which were adopting a full-on anti-tout policy. So if you had an artist like Adele or Ed Sheeran who was basically saying to their fans, don't buy touted tickets on StubHub or Viagogo because if we see tickets on those platforms, we're going to cancel them. But to stop fans or more likely touts in the secondary sites from them saying to those artists, those venues and festivals, well, now you're being anti-fan because what if fans can't come to a show? They now can't sell it on. Well, why not form an official alliance with Twickets? So you can say to your fans, not only are we going to cancel all touted tickets that we see on the main secondary sites, but if you do buy a ticket and then genuinely can't come and need to sell it on, we've picked Twickets where you can do that with our approval, and that is where you can sell it on to another fan. So you have had these standalone sites like Scarlet Mist, like Twickets, and also quite a few of Ticketmaster's competitors in the primary ticketing space have also been adding this functionality to their platforms over the last year or so. Some are more sophisticated than others. Live Nation's biggest competitor, AEG, made a big play about its new technology to allow that endorsed face value resale just a few months ago.
Yeah, and so you could say, was it pressure from anti-tout campaigners that facilitated this big move, or really was it their main competitor getting in on the fan-to-fan ethical exchanges that really made Live Nation and Ticketmaster reconsider its position?
So you can make your own decision on that.
While this is definitely a big, significant move in the ongoing secondary ticketing story, it'd be interesting to see what effect it actually has. I mean, it was obviously Ticketmaster being, I think, the biggest seller of tickets in the UK, pushing this fan-to-fan resale service definitely highlights that option to fans, but people who are buying and selling for profit aren't going to be interested in that, so that's not going to change anything for them. Obviously, two of the sites that touts use are going to be out of action, but you've still got others, StubHub and Viagogo being the big ones. And while Viagogo continues to just ignore any rules or complaints about what it does and continues to push itself hard on Google search, particularly where they kind of hoover up people who are just searching, where can I buy Ed Sheeran tickets? And then sucked in by the claims of being official and guaranteed entry or perceived claims. That's still going to exist. That's all still going to happen. But like you say, if Live Nation's on the other side of that argument, maybe that lends more weight to the anti-tout campaign that will begin to shift things. But obviously, there are countries taking legal action against Viagogo. There has been regulation in various countries, including the UK, to try to stop Viagogo acting in the way it does, but it continues to do so. So, I mean, what you've got to wonder is, like, is Viagogo on borrowed time and they're just trying to get as much money out of it as possible before they're forced to either completely change what they do or shut down? Or do they think they can get away with it?
I do think having Live Nation and Ticketmaster on the other side of this argument does make quite a big difference. It removes some of the confusion in the political community as to, well, which side is the music industry on here? It means the entire primary ticketing sector, so Ticketmaster, AEG, Axis, isn't very big here in the UK, but they're certainly growing. C-Tickets, which is big here in the UK, Eventim, which is big elsewhere in Europe. They can now all speak to regulators as one. Yes, it has been almost farcical just how willing Viagogo has been to ignore so many regulators. But, I mean, there is already litigation being pursued by the Competition and Commerce Commission, I think it's called, in Australia. Their counterparts in New Zealand just last week announced that they were now going to go legal. Here in the UK, the Competition and Markets Authority are meant to be going legal. We're expecting some announcements on that, also national trading standards. We are starting to see the regulators really starting. And okay, anything that goes through the courts, it will take time. But it does feel like momentum is now moving in that direction, where maybe Viagogo will get regulated out of certain markets. And I do think Live Nation Ticketmaster being able to sit with the rest of the music industry in saying, we don't want resale for profit, we want this to be tightly regulated, really does help the anti-tout cause in the UK and elsewhere in Europe. I think the interesting thing now is, from a Live Nation perspective, that we do have this slight disconnect that in the US, they're still very much in the secondary ticketing business. And over here in Europe, they're not. Now, I mean, maybe in the short term, having put out that sort of low-key, slightly chatty blog post, they'll now quietly shut down Seatwave and get me in the autumn, put the new Ticketmaster site online, and maybe they'll try and step back and not be part of the debate. They're no longer on the bad guys' side, but maybe they'll think, given we are still doing this elsewhere in the world, given we were quite active in second ticketing for a number of years, given that we've been adamant for years that second ticketing is a good thing, that maybe we should just not participate in this debate either way. So that might be the outcome of this. But I think if, come 2019, we did start to see Live Nation and Ticketmaster really join in this conversation in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, that could provide that extra push that might mean that these regulators finally take Viagogo to task. And of course, we're still waiting for Google to make good on their commitment to stop taking Viagogo's money, which, who knows, maybe one day they'll actually follow their own rules and their own commitment and do that. But nevertheless, quite a big development last week in the old world of ticket touting.
Still to come, the end of Cliff Richard's legal battle with the BBC. But now, Warner Chappell, Warner Music Group's music publishing company, has gone legal in a dispute with a company called Born & Co. over the rights in works composed by Jimmy Van Housen, who is probably best known for the hits he wrote for Frank Sinatra, which include Love and Marriage and Come Fly With Me.
Yeah, so this is a copyright action that has been filed in the US relating to the copyright in those works. And at the heart of this case is the good old concept of reversion rights, which we've talked about before on Setlist.
We have.
Because there's this thing in American copyright law that says that if you are a songwriter and you write a song, and therefore you are the default owner in the copyright in that song, but then you choose to assign that copyright to somebody else, so a music publisher usually, 35 years after that assignment, 35 years after that deal is done, you have the right to basically terminate the contract and have the rights revert to you as the writer. And we call that either the reversion right or the termination right. It sits in American copyright law. It was introduced in the late 1970s, but because of the 35-year thing, it only relatively recently, a few years ago, became something that writers could actually enact.
Yeah.
And so, although it's quite an old piece of American copyright law, we're still trying to work out how it works. And so there have been various test cases in recent years. How exactly does this reversion right work? How does it operate? What process do writers need to go through in order to reclaim their rights, etc., etc.? And from a UK perspective, the most interesting question that has been raised, principally by Duran Duran, but for a time also by Paul McCartney, is what if you are a British songwriter who did a deal under English law with a UK music publisher? Can you still exercise this reversion right, which is to say, reclaim your rights just in the US? Okay, so not the rest of the world, but Duran Duran reckoned they should be able to take back their rights in the US off Sony ATV, who through various acquisitions now controls the Duran Duran copyrights from the songs that they wrote back in the early 80s. So, Duran Duran sued Sony ATV over this. Sony ATV won at first instance in quite a controversial judgment that Duran Duran are now appealing. So, this whole debate around reversion rights has been going on for a few years now, has a UK element as well as a US element, but that has nothing to do with this case.
No. So, good job explaining all of that. Well, you explained what reversion rights are. So, this case, Warner Chappell versus Bourne Co., is focused on the reversion right in the UK, which doesn't exist. There isn't one. But there was at one time, back in the early 20th century, if any listeners remember that. Actually, some of them might remember that. Hello. If you remember that, hello. Hi. Well done for remembering.
And being alive.
Yeah, well done. Congratulations.
So yes, this is interesting, because usually we are talking about the American reversion right and what it means for UK songwriters. But this is a case talking about the UK reversion right and what it means for American songwriters. So it turns out that in the 1911 Copyright Act,
classic,
that's how far back we're going, there was a reversion right for songwriters, or technically for songwriters' estates, or the heirs of songwriters, because the British reversion right was different to the American reversion right, in that what the British reversion right said was that when a songwriter dies, but their copyrights live on, 25 years after the songwriter's death, the estate can terminate any previous assignment agreement and take the rights back. So that sat in British copyright law in the early part of the 20th century. However, we had a Copyright Act in the UK in 1956, which got rid of that. And then the last major overhaul of copyright legislation in the UK was in 1988, the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, and that didn't restore this reversion right. So we haven't had a reversion right under UK law since 1956. Actually, that law came into effect in 1957. However, even though that 1950s legislation got rid of the reversion right, it wasn't applied retrospectively. So songwriters and songs which were created before 1956, the reversion right still stands. And that is true of the works of this guy, Jimmy Van Heusen. And the dispute centres on a 1956 contract.
So right on the cusp.
Just before everything changed in UK copyright law. The exact specifics aren't entirely clear, because what we've got is the legal papers that Warner Chappell filed in the US courts last week. And that was actually a summons demanding that Bourne Co. come forward with a response to various questions. So we don't have all of the nitty-gritty at the heart of this case. But there was a deal in 1956 with Jimmy Van Heusen and his publishing company. So I think it actually involves some song rights other than the copyright in the works that he created. From what I can see from the legal papers that were filed last week, this company, Bourne Co., is claiming that it had an arrangement with Jimmy Van Heusen's estate that it would manage his stake in his copyrights after he died. He died in 1990. And I think there have been some disputes over the nature of that 1956 contract before. But apparently this has all come to a head in 2015 because, simple maths, he died in 1990. So that 25-year term brought us to 2015. And seemingly what's been happening since 2015 is that Bourne Co., controlling the Van Heusen estate's stake in these rights, has seemingly been saying, well, the works that were assigned under that 1956 agreement, we're now terminating that assignment, so they completely come back to us. Warner Chappell are no longer involved in this. And so they've been claiming royalties, they've been going to various collecting societies around the world and saying, we're now the beneficiary of those rights. And what then happens is that if a collecting society's database has two people both claiming the same works, so Bourne Co. and Warner Chappell, well, what can often happen then is they just don't pay anybody. And so money just gets frozen and doesn't get handed over. And so what Warner Chappell are now saying is, hang on a second, Bourne Co. is taking money that we reckon it doesn't have it rights to, and money that should be coming to us. And so these legal papers ask a number of different questions about this dispute.
Yeah, so first of all, whether or not the 1956 agreement was properly terminated. Secondly, which songs in Jimmy Van Heusen's catalogue were composed on a work for hire basis, in which case the reversion right wouldn't apply.
Yeah, that's something that's come up with the US reversion right, that if something is created later on to work for hire. So, for example, as well as writing those Frank Sinatra hits, he did quite a lot of work writing music for films. And sometimes, certainly back in the day, when you're writing music for films, you might be hired by the film studio to do that. The film studio would be the default owner of the copyright. And so the argument is the reversion right shouldn't apply. And so they're basically applying that same principle here.
And then lastly, even if some of the rights have reverted to Bourne Co. via the Jimmy Van Heusen estate, Warner reckons that a reversion right stemming from old English copyright law can only apply in the UK and Canada. So the US it keeps and the rest of the world it keeps.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why Canada.
Why not Canada?
Why not Canada? I did do some research for this story, but the research that I did, the articles I read, they didn't really go into that particular element. But that's actually an interesting point. With the US reversion rights, it has generally been accepted that what the US reversion right means is that if you assign your rights in America to a music publisher on a global basis, the reversion right only applies in the US. So you get your American rights back, but your publisher would still control the rights for the rest of the world, assuming it was a life of copyright assignment. Although there have been some lawyers in Europe who've sort of questioned that logic, because if it's a termination right that allows you to terminate the contract where the assignment took place, if that contract's terminated, then the assignment is totally terminated. So therefore, the rights should be reverting globally. And that sort of relates to the Duran Duran case, because you could say with that, well, either we apply the American reversion right, so it applies to contracts globally, including Duran Duran's UK contract with Sony ATV, but only applies to American rights, or it should only apply to American contracts for American publishing companies, but when those contracts are terminated and the rights revert, the reversion should apply globally. So there's been some sort of confusion debate around what's happening in America. But what Warner are doing here is saying, OK, it's uncontroversial under the American reversion right. It can only apply to rights within America. So even if we have to reluctantly accept this British reversion right that used to exist, and we have to accept that it applies to at least some of the songs under this contract, it would only apply in the UK and Canada. So any royalties due anywhere else in the world would still come to Warner Chappell. So hey, Bourne Co., stop messing up the collecting society databases outside the UK and Canada that's stopping us getting paid.
I can tell you how the legal papers summed all that up, if you like.
Yeah, give us a nice, snappy, concise summary of what we've just talked about, courtesy of the Warner Chappell legal filing.
Okay, I'm going to need to take a breath. Bit more. Even if the British reversionary termination rights were applicable to any of the songs and is not in any event applicable to any of the songs written on a work-for-hire basis, nor is it the application written and delivered after 1956 and subject to post-1956 agreements, which Bourne has failed to provide, such termination rights would only be applicable on information and belief to Britain and Canada and not to any of the other countries in which Bourne has caused the income from the songs, brackets, including income payable to Bourne to the heirs of the songwriters, close brackets, to be diverted and or frozen, depriving Warner of, upon information or belief, hundreds of thousands of dollars, even without the addition of interest at 9% per annum since the date such payments were diverted and or frozen.
And even though Andy inserted two very large breaths in that, we should stress that that was a single sentence.
I was trying to do it in one breath. I only got halfway through.
From Warner Chappell's legal filing there. What is it about lawyers and commas and full stops that they don't like?
I don't know, but I mean, that's just crazy.
I mean, I am known for writing long sentences, which Andy
Even
Malt...
Even you don't write sentences that long.
...usually splits up when he is doing a final sub-edit on the CMU Daily. But yeah, that is quite a sentence that doesn't do a very good job at all of summarising what this case is about. But we await a response from Bourne Co. in relation to that legal filing. But I just thought it was interesting that, for all the talk of the American reversion right causing issues, who knew that there was once... in the dim and distant past, a British reversion right that's still causing issues today.
Now, before we get to our final story this week, let's have a look at what's going on in the world of stuff you can give CMU money for.
Yeah, let's do a quick update on some of the things that have been happening in the CMU world in the last 7 days. And on the back of that long discussion of copyright matters, That sort of leads us into something that we've started publishing in the last 7 days. So CMU Trends is our service for our premium subscribers. So those of you who pay us a mere £5 a month.
Barely anything.
What a bargain. So if you become a premium subscriber, you get access to CMU Trends. So those are occasional articles that we publish that dig a bit deeper into the inner workings of the music industry. That's the strap line there.
Oh, right. Good.
That's why that sounded a little bit more pretentious than what we would normally say. But that's the official line. So yes, CMU Trends is available to our premium subscribers. And we've just launched a new thing called the CMU Trends Guide to Music Rights. So these are free articles that also sit together into one little guide that basically is an explanation of how music copyright works. That's part one. That's already been published. Actually, as the podcast goes out, part two should be there too, which is a guide to music licensing and collective licensing that we alluded to in that last story. And then part three, which will come out later this month, is basically an overview of the music rights sector and how those music rights are making money. And those three CMU Trends articles together, making up that little mini guide, in some ways they accompany the CMU Insights seminar program that we were talking about on last week's Setlist podcast. So don't forget, the CMU Insights seminars are back next month. They all take place at the London office of Lewis Silkin on Chancery Lane, and the first three are all music rights focused. And so just like the articles, there are the three seminars. The first is a beginner's guide to music copyright. The second is a beginner's guide to music licensing. The third is an overview of the music rights sector. And this CMU Trends guide sort of follows that. So you can do one or the other. Become a premium subscriber. Download the CMU Trends guides. You can either read them on the website or download them as a PDF. Or come to the seminars and have me talk to you for 2 hours and with you and answer your questions. All for the best experience. You should probably do both.
Oh, yeah.
So come to the seminars, become a premium subscriber. And we talk a lot about music copyright, music licensing on this podcast. And the thing about music copyright is, once you get into things like that frickin' Warner Chappell lawsuit we've just been talking about, it gets very complicated very quickly. It doesn't help that lawyers write those stupidly long.
Yeah.
This is why nobody understands what's going on. Lawyers can't use commas and full stops. That's the problem. It can get quite complicated quite quickly, but actually the basics are quite straightforward, and, you know, I'm kind of biased, but I do believe anyone working in the music industry, you are either owning copyrights or administrating copyrights or using copyrights, depending on which bit of the industry you're in. You should probably have a basic understanding of how music copyright works, and so these things will help you get that basic understanding. So one of two things: either become a premium subscriber, get access to the CMU Trends Guide to Music Rights and all of the other CMU Trends articles. There's a whole archive that you can navigate through the CMU library, because a lot of those articles, they're not particularly timely. They are explanations that apply today, even if they were written 2 years ago. So you can access those in CMU Library. You also get our weekly news digest, where we summarise all the key developments in 5 very punchy paragraphs with good use of commas and full stops. We don't let lawyers write that. Plus, you'll get discounts on our training courses. And if you go to cmuinsights.com, you can sign up to those free copyright seminars. You can either book into individual seminars for $49.99 or all free for £125, including VAT and booking fees. So yeah, lots of music copyright stuff going on there.
Yeah, so completemusicupdate.com/premium to sign up for CMU Premium. We'll put in links to everything we've mentioned there and all the stories we're discussing this week in the show notes for this episode, which you'll find at setlistpodcast.com. And finally this week, the BBC has decided not to appeal last month's court ruling, which said that the broadcaster infringed the privacy rights of Cliff Richard when it covered a police raid on his home in 2014. This is a story we discussed in detail a few weeks ago when that ruling was made.
Yes, so this all relates to the 2014 police raid on one of Cliff Richard's homes and the BBC's somewhat sensationalist reporting of that police raid, including a helicopter hovering above, filming all of the action. It has to be said that the BBC, particularly in recent months, has sort of said, yeah, we got it wrong. That reporting was a bit sensationalist.
Yeah.
We should have done it differently. There were lessons to be learned, they yes. said in their statement this week. So they weren't defending the style of their coverage. However, when the judgment was made last month, what the BBC said was, in the judgment, the judge said that simply stating the fact that Cliff Richard was the subject of this police investigation, oblivious of how they then covered the subsequent raid, merely naming Richard in their report, that in itself had breached Cliff Richard's privacy rights. He, of course, sued the BBC and initially actually also the police force who were responsible for the raid because of the way that they had liaised with the BBC, although he did settle with the police. But he had sued the BBC, and in the judgment last month, the judge awarded him £210,000 in basic damages. Subsequent to that, the BBC have also committed to cover a whole load of Cliff Richard's legal fees. But what the BBC was saying up until last week was, we think we probably need to appeal this judgment, not because we're necessarily standing by the style of our coverage, not necessarily because we begrudge Cliff Richard his damages or covering his legal fees, but because we think this judgment has set a dangerous precedent that is extending the privacy rights to the extent that they are now interfering with freedom of expression and the right of a free press, and we don't want that precedent set in stone. And so, the last we'd heard up until last week's announcement was the BBC were sitting down with their lawyers and investigating taking this matter to the Court of Appeal. But last week they said, we're not going to do that, and they issued quite a long statement explaining why.
Yeah, I mean, the general gist was they've been told if they appeal it, they'll probably lose again. And so that would cost the it would cost the licence fee payers a lot more money, and it would prolong Cliff Richard's distress, and that isn't what the BBC wants to do.
Yeah, and if the appeal court just upheld the original ruling, then they wouldn't achieve anything. In fact, they sort of feel that that would set that precedent even firmer into the law. So yeah, the statement that the BBC put out was very much saying, even though we apologise to Cliff Richard, even though we didn't want to put Cliff Richard through any more distress, we were very seriously considering taking this, and they went back through all of their arguments as to why they think this sets a dangerous precedent in UK media law. And it has to be said, it's not just the BBC saying this. Lots of other news organisations, including newspapers who famously hate the BBC, have also been expressing concern about this judgment. But yeah, what they said was, our lawyers told us there's a very high chance that we would lose the appeal. They then explained that it's quite a complicated case, and there were various different elements to the judgment, and that the appeal judges would have to take this particular point about this precedent being set away from all the other elements of the case, and the lawyers who were advising them were saying, we're not sure the appeal judges would be willing to do that. So yeah, they're basically saying, we're not going to appeal. However, they remain concerned about the precedent has been set, and so instead they're going to write to the government.
Yes, and ask the government to instigate a review of the law on this. In fact, in its statement, the BBC said, the BBC is writing today to ask the government to consider a review of the law in this important area to protect the right to properly and fairly reported criminal investigations and to name the person under investigation. There is a fundamental principle of press freedom at stake here, and one which we believe Parliament, as our lawmakers, should decide.
Earlier in the statement, the BBC went back through the arguments which we discussed last time we talked about this on Setlist, which is, while there are sometimes concerns about naming individuals who are the subject of police investigations, particularly when, as in this case, they're relating to allegations of sexual abuse. Now, obviously, at the end of this investigation, no charges were filed against Cliff Richard because of a lack of evidence. And so the argument is there were no charges here, but the reporting of the investigation tarnished his reputation, and so maybe he shouldn't have been named. That said, what the BBC and most other broadcasters and newspaper owners would say is, when you report on police investigations of this kind and you name the individual who is being investigated, then sometimes what happens is other people come forward who have important evidence for the investigation. So actually the reporting plays a useful role. Plus, of course, it means the media can be scrutinising what the police are doing. And so these are the various reasons why the BBC think that there are issues with that judgment and they want the government to do something about it. We mentioned that they are actually backed by quite a lot of their competitors in this regard, including some of the trade organisations for the journalism and media sector. So I think the Societies of Editors were one of the people who were backing this.
Yes, their executive director Ian Murray said, Parliament should now urgently consider whether such a step towards individual privacy against the protection of society's overall liberties is acceptable. The society recognises that the sympathies of the public may well strongly be with Sir Cliff on this issue and in this particular case, but there are bigger issues at stake that, if unchallenged, will affect the liberties of all citizens.
Yes, and a number of newspaper editors were also coming forward with their own calls on the government to do something about this because of all of these dangerous precedents they believe are being set in British media law.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece in Private Eye on all of this, basically saying that actually a lot of the claims about what precedent this sets are not true. But what they did say is that it means that people can launch claims based on privacy law rather than defamation law. And under privacy law, you don't have to prove that you've been financially damaged by what's happened. And so it potentially makes it easier to make a claim. And some lawyers have already started doing that. I mean, pretty much immediately upon this case being ruled upon, some of the bigger law firms that handle celebrity cases of this type.
So some ambulance chasers.
Started putting in claims to newspapers.
Are already chasing some ambulances. Yeah, because I suppose with defamation, with libel, there are two elements to that. You have to prove, A, that there was an untruth, but also that the untruth caused damage. So actually, you can lie about people all you like, providing it doesn't financially damage and damage their reputation and so on and so forth. That's interesting what they're saying with the privacy case. You just have to show that privacy was violated, not that it had any negative impact on the person. So it's going to make those cases easier. Will be interesting to see whether or not the government does respond on this. I mean, obviously, they are quite busy at the moment with...
There's a few things going on. Well, they're not that busy, are they? I mean, they're off for their summer holidays.
That's true. But you have to think that when they come back for the next 6 months, there's going to be quite a lot of other stuff on their mind rather than sorting out media law. But we'll be interested to see whether government and or parliament respond to these various calls to try and get some clarity in law on these issues rather than just relying on the slightly loose right to privacy and indeed free speech provided in the Human Rights Act and the various judgments that have been made that have clarified what that means over the years.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, contact us on social media, or you could email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Give us your opinions, tell us we're wrong, tell us we're right, I'm going to rephrase all of that. If you want to email us and tell us we're right, just email setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
If you're a California media company in need of some guidance and counsel from a British person with no training or qualifications to provide that guidance or training, but more than willing to take your cash, then hey, Disney, you know where I am.
Well, yeah. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe, who I really apologise to this week.
There's been a lot of...
And I hope that...
stopping and starting.
I hope that makes no sense why I have apologised to him at this stage, because he's done such a great job. I'm very ill.
There was a weird guy in the building across the way.
There was a weird guy looking
staring
at
us for about half the podcast.
How are we supposed to work in these conditions?
But hopefully Jason will sort all that out. But if there's
You can't edit that guy out.
No, you can't edit the guy out.
Although he's gone.
He has gone.
Yeah, he's gone.
So if there were bits of this podcast that didn't make sense, it's not Jason's fault in the edit. It's
because... the guy in the window.
We were so disturbed by the guy in the window that what we handed over to Jason was impossible to edit coherently. Plus, of course, there was that very long quote from those lawyers with no commas and full stops. That wasn't our fault. That wasn't even the fault of the guy across the way.
Well, we don't know. We don't know who he was. He might have written it.
He might be Warner Chappell's lawyer.
Maybe he heard his sentence being uttered and that's what happened.
That's why
I recognise that sentence. I'd recognise that sentence anywhere.
Anyway, I do believe you were wrapping up the podcast.
Oh yeah, I was, wasn't I? Oh yeah. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.